Let's return to Isaiah chapter 49, and we'll scroll back to verse number 14 to get our context here. Isaiah's prophecies are a mixture of things that are going to happen with the Babylonian exile, with the return from that exile, with the reestablishment of Jerusalem and the temple in preparation for the coming of the Messiah. But then we can also talk about the redemption provided through the atoning death of that Messiah, followed up later by his coming to bring everything to its climax with a new heaven and a new earth and the gathering together of all those that have been redeemed. So we've got a lot of stuff spread over a long period of time, some of it in the future yet to us, throughout these sections of the book of Isaiah. And one of the things that comes up in Isaiah's prophecy is that the people who deal with the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem and the temple and being taken away into exile, they're going to feel like God's not taken care, that God's abandoned them. And nothing could be further from the truth. God cares. Yes, there has to be some judgment. Yes, there has to be some consequences for sins. But he is working it all out. Working it out in a bigger way than what they could even imagine. And so we have, I believe, in the following verses, a mixture of the return from Babylon and Assyria to rebuild Jerusalem in the 6th century BC as a prep for the coming of the Messiah, but also some hinting at the second coming of Jesus when he will remake the world into the paradise it was intended to be. He'll do away with the old world and recreate it or create a new heaven, a new earth in which righteousness will dwell. And so you have to have your head wrapped around multiple things being talked about at the same time. So Isaiah 49:14. Zion, which is often a reference to the Temple Mount. Zion said, "He who is has forsaken me. My Lord's forgotten me." And so they feel in their exile abandoned because everything has fallen apart. Jerusalem's destroyed, temple's destroyed. Verse 15, God's response, "Can a woman forget her nursing child that she have no compassion on the son of her womb?" Not likely, although on very rare occasions it might happen. So God goes on and says, "Even these may forget, yet I will not forget you." So God's promise is, no, I'm not forgetting you. You are important to me. "Behold, I've engraved you on the palms of my hands," which I told you last time as we were kind of wrapping up. I can't get past that phrase without thinking of Jesus taking the nails in his wrists at the base of his palms. That marked him. It engraved him with the redemption on our behalf. So he's not going to forget us. "Your walls are continually before us." The imagery is about Jerusalem being rebuilt, but remember that Jesus builds all of us into the ultimate temple of praise, into the ultimate city of assembly with him for eternity. Yes, I believe there will be a literal New Jerusalem. I think there will be a literal millennial Jerusalem. But I think that we have to also read into this passage that we who bear the name are part of the temple of praise and the city of praise. All right, verse 17. This is where we kind of ran out of time last time. Your builders make haste, your destroyers and those who laid you waste go out from you. Lift your eyes up around and see. They all gather, they come to you. As I live, declares he who is, you shall put them all on as an ornament. You shall bind them on as a bride does. All right, so Jerusalem in the 6th century BC will be rebuilt, and then it'll be adorned and expanded and made glorious for the arrival of the Messiah in the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD. Some of the people involved in rebuilding and bringing everybody back are from the people groups that did so much damage, that destroyed the buildings and the cities that the Israelis were taken out of. And so it's going to be kind of a reversal here. It's going to be an ironic shoe is on the other foot, that these folks are going to be more interested in helping rebuild the Israelis as a people group rather than their ancestors destroying them. And honestly, I think we can also apply that to the second coming of Jesus. Many ethnic groups that were involved in the persecution of the Israelis have turned around and produced an awful lot of Christians, people who love Jesus with all their heart, soul, and strength. And so we do what we can to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem that our ancestors may have been involved in. Verse 20, the children of your bereavement will yet say in your ears, the place is too narrow for me. Make room for me to dwell in. This is a population issue, meaning that as they start coming back more and more and more and more, Jerusalem ain't big enough for everybody. And Judea needs more space. And so they're going to be like, this is too small a place for all of us. Verse 21, then you will say in your heart, who has borne me these? I was bereaved and barren, exiled, put away. But who's brought up these? Behold, I was left alone, but where have these come? So the idea being that the people that went into exile, they were a smaller number because a lot of people had been killed. They were not a very powerful people. They were being relocated. And then suddenly, now, everything's turned around. There's a ton of them. And they're coming back, and they're like, wow, where'd all these people come from? And some of them, by the way, are Gentiles that have converted to Judaism and have wanted to be part of this new story of Israel. Verse 22, thus says he who is God, behold, I will lift up my hand to the nations and raise my signal to the peoples. We've seen that language before about the Messiah being the signal to the nations. It's in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 12 specifically. And so we have the idea that once the Messiah shows up, he's going to be a signal bringing in even more Gentiles. And we know that about the church. The church started out with a Jewish core to it. But once God opened the doors to Gentile evangelism through the story of Cornelius, then suddenly Gentiles came in droves and soon eclipsed the number of Jews that were within the church. And that's not surprising because Gentiles make up a lot larger ratio of the world population than Jewish people do. They shall bring your sons in their arms, and your daughters shall be carried on their shoulders. Some people like to apply this to the returns of people, Israeli people, in the modern era, that once the 1800s rolled around and the Zionist movement got started because of pogroms in Russia and other places, a pogrom being this attempt to eradicate Jews, to persecute Jews just because they were Jewish. And then World War I, and then World War II, and the Holocaust. Tons of ethnic Israelis started going to Israel. And many Gentiles helped them in that process, encouraged that process. And so they look at this verse 22 as being fulfilled in that. Verse 23, kings shall be your foster fathers and their queens your nursing mothers. With their faces to the ground, they shall bow down to you and lick the dust of your feet. Now, this is the shoe is on the other foot sort of passage, that some of the ethnic groups that did so much damage to the Israeli people through the ages will end up at least somewhat represented by people wanting to help them out. And then you will know that I am he who is, and those who wait for me shall not be put to shame. So it's basically God in this prophetic passage saying, wait, be patient, trust me, I will work it all out for good to those who love me and who have been called according to my purposes. That's Romans 8:28, isn't it? So that same concept still goes on within Christianity. Verse 24, can the prey be taken from the mighty, or the captives of a tyrant be rescued? That's intended to be rhetorical, that no, it's not easy to do that. If you try to take the antelope away from the lion that took it down, you better be pretty strong and you better have a good plan. If you go into a place where there is a very powerful ruler, you know, that is, you know, completely and fully in charge, to try to take people that he's kidnapped or imprisoned away from him, you better have a really good plan. Verse 25, for thus says he who is, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken, and the prey of the tyrant will be rescued. So when God does it, he can get it done. Doesn't matter how powerful those other bad actors are, God can do it. For I will contend with those who contend with you, and I will save your children. So the point of this passage is to help the Israelis from Isaiah's time forward understand they can trust God. That if they will just stick with him, he will get them out of hock. He will get them out of exile. He will get them out of sin because they're his children and he's going to save them. I will make your oppressors eat their own flesh. They will be drunk with their own blood as with wine. A reference to warfare that happens at certain times in Israeli history, I think, bringing the Israeli people back to the Israeli homelands, particularly in preparation for the first coming of Jesus. But then we have to flash forward to the second coming of Jesus. We know that there's going to be a lot of death and destruction brought on by the wrath of God in that final 3.5 year period. Then all flesh shall know that I am he who is your Savior, your Redeemer, the Mighty One of Jacob. So when God fixes it clearly, then even those who are enemies have to acknowledge he is whom he is. Chapter 50. Thus says he who is. Where's your mother's certificate of divorce with which I sent her away? Now that's echoes from the book of Hosea, isn't it? Where God was talking about divorcing the covenant people that weren't keeping the covenant. He was going to take away all their stuff and kick them out of his country into exile. So now we revisit that idea. Or which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? That also has an echo in the book of Hosea, because Gomer ended up so far in debt that Hosea had to pay off that debt in order to get her back home again. And that was all representative of God, that God loved his people enough that even when they got themselves in trouble and sold into sin, that he wanted to redeem them. Behold, for your iniquities you were sold, for your transgressions your mother was sent away. Why, when I came, was there no man? Why, when I called, was there no one to answer? Now, I love how this sets the stage for a later messianic passage, that God could have hoped, I suppose, that somebody would do the right thing and help when things weren't fair, step in and fix it. But then he realizes, no, nobody's doing anything. They're letting it slide to their own benefit. And so he says, is my hand shortened that it cannot redeem? Have I no power to deliver? So am I incapable of fixing the problem that other people are ignoring? Behold, by my rebuke I dry up the sea, I make the rivers a desert, their fish stink for lack of water and die of thirst. Now we know of some good examples of God drying up the water for the crossing of the Red Sea, the crossing of the Jordan River. I get the impression from this that maybe there were some fish flip-flopping around when all that happened. But God's the one that dried it up. So God's rhetorical question is, if I can do that, can't I do anything? Verse 3, I clothe the heavens with blackness and make sackcloth their coverings. So I'm the creator God. I made everything up there in the sky. If I did that, can't I do anything? Verse 4, he who is God has given me the tongue of those who are taught, that I may know how to sustain with a word him who is weary. So now we're back to that servant idea, I think, where the servant of God is given the ability by God to comfort other people, to help them understand it'll be okay. Morning by morning he awakens. He awakens my ear to hear as those who are taught. He who is has opened my ear. I wasn't rebellious. I turned not backward. Now, at this point, verse 6 is going to suddenly make it clear that Jesus is in mind. Up to this point, we could have thought it might have been Isaiah, or it might have been some other prophet. But when we read verse 6, I gave my back to those who strike and my cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting. That's pretty obviously a prophecy encoded about Jesus, that he is the servant of God, that is listening to the words of God and bringing it here to planet Earth intact to pass it on. He is obedient to his Father's directions to be he who is salvation. And in the process, he gets beaten up. on the night that he was betrayed. He was taken away by the Jewish security forces to a preliminary hearing at the high priest's residence. And once they had come to the conclusion that he deserved to be condemned to death, they turned him over to the tormentors. And they were whacking on him hard and punching him in the face. And according to this passage, they were apparently pulling big patches of his beard out and spitting in his face because of their contempt for him. And he did that so that he could deliver the message of God's love and compassion and mercy and salvation and redemption. Verse 7. But he who is God helps me. Therefore, I have not been disgraced. Therefore, I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be put to shame. So, testimony of Jesus ahead of time here. Yeah, they're going to do some pretty disgraceful things to me, but it won't disgrace me because I am on a mission. I am making my face firm to get the job done. He who vindicates me is near. Who will contend with me? That is, who will bring me up on charges? He was brought up on trumped on up charges. Pilate, when he was looking over the material, said, I find no guilt in this man. I see no capital crime guilt. So Jesus, in this ancient prophecy, says, no, who can bring a lawsuit? Nobody. Let us stand up together. Who's my adversary? Let him come near to me. That is, who's going to come and accuse me of being a sinner? Nobody. He was tempted in every way, like unto ourselves, but he had no sin. So nothing could attach itself to him. Behold, he who is God helps me. Who will declare me guilty? Obviously, nobody. Behold, all of them will wear out like a garment. The moth will eat them up. So the people who try to bring up charges against him, they will fail. They will pass away from the scene. Who among you fears he who is and obeys the voice of his servant? And if Jesus is the servant in mind here, who's going to fear the Lord and obey the voice of Jesus, the Son of God? Let him who walks in darkness and has no light trust in the name of he who is and rely on his God. So we're all caught up in the darkness of sin, and here comes the Messiah bringing the light, bringing his name, the power of his name, he who is salvation, Yehoshua. We need to trust in that. Behold, all you who kindle a fire, who equip yourselves with burning torches, walk by the light of your fire and by the torches you've kindled. This you have from my hand, you shall lie down in torment. So some people are going to try to find their own way through the darkness. But moving from one dark place to another dark place by your own light, that's not going to cut it. Jesus talked about if somebody has this guilty eye, this sinful eye, then they have no light in themselves. In fact, whatever light is in them is darkness. The only light that's going to make a difference in this dark world is the light of Jesus. And that's what Isaiah's prophecy is preparing the people for. Chapter 51. Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness. You who seek he who is. So those of you that are serious about this, those of you who want to chase down righteousness, those of you that want to find God, then look to the rock from which you were hewn, to the quarry from which you were dug, which is an interesting idiom about get back to your roots. Go back to where you started as a people. Verse 2, look to Abraham, your father, to Sarah, who bore you. Abraham is the father of faith. A big deal is made by that by the Apostle Paul in the New Testament. We are his children because we have that same faith. Sarah was also part of that equation. For he was but one when I called him, that I might bless him and multiply him. So, one guy, one woman, a couple, a power couple, but they didn't have any kids. And so that's how their story starts. But that's not where their story ends, is it? Because God said, I am going to bless you and multiply you and make your seed like the sands on the shore, like the stars in the sky. And here we are, all of us who are the children of Abraham, whether we have a drop of Jewish blood in us or not, doesn't matter. If we have the same faith in Jesus, then we are the children of Abraham, and he is the beginning of our story. He's the rock from which we were hewn, the quarry from which we were dug. We go back to the basics. And that's what God, through Isaiah, is calling the Israelis from Isaiah's time forward to do. Get back to God. Get back to faith. Mark your place. We'll get back into God's Word next time we can.